I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Laura Cumming. On her new book, Thunderclap, a memoir of art and life and sudden death.
Laura Cumming has been chief art critic of The Observer since 1999. Her books include A Face to the World, On Self-Portraits, and The Vanishing Man, In Pursuit of Velázquez, which won the James Tate Black Biography Prize. Her family memoir, On Chapel Sands, My Mother and Other Missing Persons, was a Sunday Times bestseller and shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford, Costa and Rathbones Folio Prizes. And today we're going to be talking about Laura's latest book, which is Thunderclap, a memoir of art and life and sudden death. Laura, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be here again, Neil. I've always enjoyed doing the podcast with you and they're always the first ones I do.
So tell us, first of all, then, what the idea is behind this one.
Yeah, the title of the book is Thunderclap. The thunderclap was an explosion that occurred in Delft in 1654 and destroyed huge parts of this very, very small canal-ringed city in the Netherlands. And the person who died in that, who I am most interested in, of the many untold numbers, is Carol Fabricius, who was the artist who painted The Goldfinch, the very famous painting, The Goldfinch. And he was just gone at the age of 32 in the space of a few hours on that day. So the book relates to that event and his life and everything that preceded it and the strange mystery of what happened to his paintings and what happened to his reputation after that. But Thunderclap, the title also refers to the thunderclap of sight, which is, I suppose, my primary subject all the way through the book. The thunderclap of seeing an absolutely astounding painting and feeling that your whole understanding of life has changed, or the thunderclap that is a revelation to do with sight and seeing. There are moments in the book where people's actual eyesight is changed in some way by a thunderclap. In the case of my younger daughter, she went colourblind from looking too hard at the sun in a thunderclap and so on. So the book is literal but also metaphorical in its title.
And the book also looks at the life and career of James Cumming, the artist, and your own father. And we'll talk about him in a minute, but just staying with something you've just raised about the idea of sight and the idea of, you know, a sudden, like suddenly seeing something or something suddenly changing. One of the concepts in the book is something called the idea of a person's picture world. So tell us what you mean by that.
Yes, my first picture, my first painting that I ever saw, apart from my father's paintings, he was a painter too, was in a primary school class when I just started school on my first day in Edinburgh and in a brand new school. And on the wall of this classroom was hanging a painting of a Dutch ice scene from the 17th century. This is my century, very much the subject of this book. And you know, all these tiny little figures are all, you know, skating around and eating and talking and conversing and playing games and primitive form of a thing called golf, which is ice, the game of golf on the ice. And I loved this painting and it was getting very vivid to me. And I knew it was an old painting because the colours in it were very sort of faded compared to the brilliant colours of the 1960s, which is when I was going to school for the first time. And we were being taught using cuisinaire rods, which were a math system. Maybe some of your listeners have seen these. I don't know if they're used anymore, but all numbers had colors and lengths of rod. So number 10 was bright red, and, you know, number 5 was green and so on. And number 1 was white, a tiny little white cube, a centimeter square of wood. And the painting that I was looking at on the wall was pretty much all white because it was an ice scene, but with these rather beautiful, smoky pink tinges in the sky and a distant perspective of pale grey buildings way away across the ice. And I loved the painting, and I thought it was a painting. And of course, it wasn't a painting at all. It was a reproduction. My father, who picked me up from school, explained to me that this was a Dutch winter landscape by Hendrik Averkamp, about whom I talk a lot in the book because he's a very strange figure. And when I said, well, if it's Dutch, why isn't it in Dutchland? And he said, well, it's a scene of the Dutch in the Netherlands, but the original painting is in the Netherlands. It is Dutch. You're looking at a reproduction. And I guess I was about 4 and I didn't really know what a reproduction was. I think this is quite common, Neil. I think a lot of people think they're looking at the original of a painting when they see something that's quite big, not a postcard, not a Christmas card. Lots of Dutch paintings were coming on Christmas cards, of course. And so I was pretty fascinated. It was the first picture in my picture world. And my picture world developed. I mean, I saw paintings. I saw a lot of paintings in the house, my father's paintings. But I also came to the image world, as I think we mostly do, through reproduction. So everybody now, obviously, it's, you know, mobile phone images and so on. But for me, it was strange things like little prints and card games that had pictures printed on the back. And the key moment in this story, which is also a story of being absolutely passionately interested in Dutch 17th century painting, you know, there's still life and the scudding ship and the fish on the table and the Dutch burgers and so on, and all the things we think of, Vermeer, Rembrandt, Hals and so on. The key thing for me was being taken, I think I'm about 8, maybe, or 9. I can't quite remember when this occurs, though, because I didn't ever write it down, but I thought I was getting too fat. I was at school with all these thin girls. And so my mother said, well, why don't we go to the doctor, the family doctor, in this very sort of gloomy surgery just up the road from where we lived in Edinburgh. And I got weighed. And I mean, ritual weighing, and it went on every week. And you could see that a kind of a neurosis could easily have set in, possibly did. But it also came with a very joyful thing, which was the reward I got when I lost the weight, which was a sequence of Dutch postcards. And this guy, this very hardworking family doctor, he was there in the evening and came to your house and, you know, delivered babies and so on. And he'd obviously had a holiday where he'd gone to the Mauritshuis in The Hague because he had all these postcards of famous paintings. And so these famous paintings became very important to me. I treasured the cards. And one of them was, of course, The Goldfinch by Carol Fabricius, which is the first time I ever saw it. It was in black and white. And I was completely enthralled by it. And all the way through this book, these postcards turn, as it were, they come to life in my life, but they also finally are seen by me in actual galleries during different phases of my life. So eventually I see the Goldfinch for real, as it were, in that very museum, and it's a thunderclap.
You talk about your father's actual works, how his painting changes roughly halfway through his painting career. He becomes a completely different painter. Or he takes on a completely different project, I should say. But I want to talk really about what are your early memories of him as a painter, as somebody who did painting as a job?
Well, I think this is one of the great blessings of my life because I'm an art critic and I can't paint, incidentally, at all. Not bad at the sculpting, but rubbish at painting. But my house, both my parents were artists, so this is what they did for a job. And there's a moment in the book where I'm describing that first day at school where they went around the class, very sexist, as we would think now, but they were asking all the kids in the class what their fathers did for a living. And so we get to me and I say, he's a painter. And the woman asking me, Miss Rogan, the primary school teacher, says, well, what kind of painter? You know, I mean, is it a house painter or, you know? And I had no idea that there really was any other kind of painter than the kind that my father was. So a man, he got up in the morning and, you know, went upstairs to his the bedroom that he converted into a studio and painted solidly all day, sometimes with the door locked for peace. And what he painted was this kind of painting called semi-figurative painting, that was called. That's to say, you could see it was quasi-abstract, but there were figures moving around in it. These were all paintings that he had made that remembered the 2 years he spent in really acute poverty and quite a lot of misery, but also utter revelatory joy on the island of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides, where the life was very strange and penurious, and he became very deeply involved in the strivings of the people on this very barren island without trees and so on. And so I was used to the idea that painters did that kind of thing. And it never surprised me, therefore, when I grew up and went out into the world, you know, that galleries were full of semi-figurative paintings, abstract paintings, and so on, as well as the kind of Dutch paintings I'd seen when I was at home. And I think it was a huge advance for me, because I knew that what he was making was a sequence of visions that recorded the strange experiences he had had over a period of years. And in this case, many years before, in fact, the memories of this island life. And he was very particularly concerned with this strange phenomenon you see, and it's still the case on the island of Lewis, where people have a thing called second sight. So you see my theme is building up. Second sight is where you're able to see the future. And it's pictorial. So the original figure of who had the greatest second sight is a man called the Bran Seer. Bran after the castle where he worked on the Black Isle in Scotland. And a seer, he could see far into the future. And the things he saw all took the form of images, if you like. So he predicted the coming of railways in the Highlands. And this was, you know, black horses, metal, charging through the landscape and so on. And he predicted a time when Scotland would have its freedom again, when men could walk over the water to France. And that clearly is to do with Eurostar and, you know, that particular era and so on. And so everything he imagined about the future and everything he predicted came in the form of an image. And my father ultimately painted a, I think, tremendous vision of him. This is a 17th century figure. And he imagines him as this extraordinary, strange figure, almost one with a landscape, who is striding forward but looking backwards and has this very weird eye that he turns on you. Can he see you? Is he seeing you in the future and so on? And part of the book is an attempt to discover the whereabouts of that painting, which was lost just around the time that I was born and has never been seen since. I just have a little slide of it.
With the possible exception of one particular Spanish painter, which you're entirely responsible for, Laura, whenever I think of painting, all of my favourite paintings are Dutch. They're all the Dutch masters. I just adore it. And there was actually, it seems, a time a while ago after these Dutch masters had been painting where Dutch painting was not very popular. Let's talk about why.
Yes, I think that's very true. And there's a very simple answer. There was far too much of it. In the 17th century, everybody bought paintings in the Netherlands. It's an astonishing time and place, and it never happens again in the whole of history. So in the book I've written about wonderful inventories in Leiden and Utrecht and Amsterdam and so on, where you can see from people's wills, you know, that everybody had paintings. They had paintings. They sometimes had 60 paintings in one room. Some people had them in the basement. Some people had them in the attic. You know, they're absolutely everywhere, and everyone owned them. So not just, you know, the burgher with his white ruff and his, you know, large house on the Prinsengracht Canal in Amsterdam, but blacksmiths and innkeepers and chemists and so on. And people were making these amazing numbers of paintings. Some of the artists in my book are making thousands of paintings, you know, not Fabricius, who makes practically none, and everybody's buying them. And this wonderful democratization of the Dutch in this era, where they start to want images of themselves and everything that they do and everything that they see and everything in their house. And we think about the amazing paintings of Vermeer, for example, where, you know, light is burnishing the room and the milkmaid is standing with the jug in this amazing sweet session of silent thought and so on. But it's also a record of a room with an actual person in it and quite a lot of crockery. And lots and lots and lots of Dutch paintings are very, very like that in the elements that they want to portray. And I love this. I like the fact that they painted themselves drunk. I like the fact that they painted themselves smoking. I like the fact that they painted absolutely brilliant images of what I suppose we could call the ideal home. I'm thinking of the art of Peter de Hoogh, as well as Vermeer, where a woman has created such beauty in the home that the painter, in turn, pays homage to her by painting it. There's a painting in the book that just is a wonderful, wonderful image by the Hooch of it's called Made in a Courtyard with a Pail and a Brush. And that's exactly what it is. And you can picture the red brick and you can picture the beautiful sky and the Dutch gable ends and so on. But in this case, the pail is burnished copper inside and the painter has propped it on its side so that it appears to be looking at the sun, which is going down in the distance in this courtyard. And I thought to myself when I saw that painting, which is in Germany, that the pail is like the eye and the sight of everything, this revelation to all these artists, is what they're actually recording. The amazing fact of being able to see a beautiful twinkling canal or a silver fish on a dish, or, you know, a vase of amazing tulips in flaming colours and so on. So I love it because there's so much of it, and it went everywhere. It travelled out into the world, and by the end of that century, there were Dutch paintings just literally everywhere. I mean, they were in America, they were in Russia, they were in Norway. Everybody had some, and there were too many of them. And of course, it's true that, you know, some of these paintings were not perhaps anywhere near as great as the works of Hals or Rembrandt or Vermeer or Carol Fabricius. But nonetheless, there was a wonderful kind of feeling that the whole of Dutch life is pictured. And that when you are seeing one of these paintings, which you see absolutely everywhere in rural galleries and galleries across the world and so on, that you're stepping back into this pictured world, which I just love.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Laura Cumming, and we're talking about her book, Thunderclap, a memoir of art and life and sudden death. And Laura, just one more thing about Dutch painting in general before we go on to talk about Fabricius and maybe some of the other lesser-known Dutch painters that you talk about in the book. You've just described, I mean, you know, the Netherlands at this time is this Hanseatic, Protestant, very proper, very concerned about business and money. There's all of these pictures of these men in, as you said, ruffs and dressed in black and hats and things. And we picture, you know, Rembrandt's portraits, they're often very dark. And so that's a sort of very distinct look and style that we think, you know, influences these paintings. But there's obviously other things. And one of them, the Netherlands has, you know, a particularly unique landscape, for instance. But perhaps even more importantly, what you talk about in the book is the weather. And this time, the time of the Dutch masters, coincides with the Little Ice Age. So tell us something about the influence of the weather on these paintings.
Well, you see, the Little Ice Age is this absolutely appalling phase. It comes and it goes, but it's over a period of about 70 years. And it seizes the whole country. It takes grip of everything. Everything is white. The canals freeze right over. The Baltic Sea froze during those years. I mean, it was as unbelievable. And the thing I love so much about the Dutch is the fact that they just get on with going outside and living in it. There is nothing else to do. So Dutch paintings are absolutely full of scenes in which people are selling goods, they're skating, they're dancing. The painting that's in my primary school class comes straight to mind. And they just transfer their lives outside into it. And they're brave, and they develop skating as their great national sport. So they skate down these canals. There are still canal races where they, you know, people can, when the canals freeze over, they skate for miles and miles and, you know, miles right across the country. And so I love that about them. And the landscape also, even when it melts, I love the flat, strange. It's a bit related to me in my mind to the book I last wrote on Chapel Sands, which is set in Lincolnshire, directly across the North Sea from the Netherlands. And I love these long linear landscapes where you see lines of poplars, sort of as if we're measuring the perspective. And one of the paintings in the book is the avenue at Middle Harness, which your listeners may have seen. It's just a wild painting, a kind of parallax view. These incredible tall trees, sort of hyper tall trees, converging on a flashpoint in the distance. It's in the National Gallery in London. And it's just a crazy thing to look at. There's nothing like it in landscape painting. And my special feeling about the artists in this book is that what they're doing, for all our idea of, you know, cheese and tulips and clogs and skates and so on, everything the ones that I love are doing, everything is original and strange. And so is that extraordinary painting.
So Carol Fabricius or Fabritius, let's talk about, I guess, first of all, why there are so few paintings.
Well, this is the thing I set out to find, because there were really, when I started writing the book, there were probably maybe 10 paintings by him that were known, but to be by him. And I think it's possible I might have come across one more. 11 paintings in a painting career probably starts in when he's 17 and ends with his death at 32. That's pathetic. I mean, it's so small. You think to yourself, how can it possibly be? He's supposed to have trained in the studio of Rembrandt. He goes to Amsterdam from his little village out in the watery flatlands north of Amsterdam. And I think to myself, why are there no more paintings? Because all of the pupils of Rembrandt were really prolific, more or less to a fault, but not him. And so the more I researched, the more I discovered the tragedies of his existence. What I discover is that he marries the girl next door in the village in Midden-Beavester, where he comes from, and they have children. They have one child who dies. They have another child who dies. They have a third child who dies. And she dies, probably giving birth to the second child. And it's very strange and mysterious. And by the time he's 21, they're all dead. His entire family has been wiped out. And he returns to the village of his birth and remains there. And nothing more is heard of him. And I searched and I searched. And I can find one really magnificent portrait. And I can find one very strange painting of a Bible scene, but really nothing. And it's my contention in the book that what happens to him is that he's paralyzed with grief. He just completely falls apart and doesn't paint anymore. And there are the Dutch kept amazing numbers of records, as you know, everything all the time. They're really punctilious about paperwork. And so I know, I've seen everything I can find of him, and I know that he kept on having to borrow money, and then more money and more money, and it gets worse and worse. And eventually he marries again and he goes to live in Delft. And he goes there for a very, very few years before he's blown up in the explosion. And in Delft, he joins a kind of art community. There are all these wonderful painters living there, notably Vermeer, who's younger, and Peter de Hoek, who's a little bit older. And he starts to paint incredible paintings, really strange and wonderful paintings. And the one that the book starts with is A View of Delft, which is also in the National Gallery, which is a really, really, it's almost like a work of romanticism, and it shows a man brooding in a corner. I always think he looks like he's just picked a bit of tobacco from his mouth, and like he's got a roll up, and he's thinking, and he's very melancholy. And there's the view of Delft on the other side of the painting, seen to be very, he's like, he's on the wrong side of the street, he's in the darkness, and it's very bright over there. And I found it was one of the first paintings I ever saw when I came to London in my 20s. And then I always found this painting really haunting. Nobody looks at it. Everybody walks past it. It's really tiny. I think it's a masterpiece. Anyway, he painted that when he got to Delft. That's more or less his street. And the view of Delft he paints, the street scenes that he's painting. The street scenes that he's painting in the picture will be the ones through which his own body is carried to its grave, not very much longer after the painting has been completed. So there are very weird things going on. Nothing he paints is like the last painting. He paints solitary figures, always very, I think, very mournful. And uppermost of these is this painting of a finch, a goldfinch, alone on its perch, tethered forever. It's a really tragic and brilliant painting. And I came eventually to equate Fabricius the painter with the goldfinch in his most famous painting, a very solitary and trapped people, both of them, well, figures, both of them. So his story is, I'm following his story all through the book, trying to work out when everybody else is painting hundreds of skating scenes or seascapes, what it is about this strange and very great painter that he doesn't paint. And that's my going to be as there is more to it in the book.
Tell us some more about the explosion. What actually happens?
The explosion it comes at the end of a long war with the Spaniards. The Dutch have kept a lot of gunpowder under the ground. It's in a disused nunnery at the end of the street where Fabricius lives. And a guy called Poor Man, who's literally atomized and never seen again, a clerk called Sotens, is sent to check that the store is, you know, everything's shipshape in the store. And nobody really knows quite. My conjecture on spending a lot of time discussing this with some wonderful experts at the Blast Institute in Sheffield, who are authorities on, and they're like the Bellingcat of explosions. They always try to work out how explosions occur. During the course of writing this book, it was this terrible, devastating explosion. Your listeners may remember in Beirut. And it's exactly the same story, which is that there's gunpowder in a place that it shouldn't be. In Beirut, it was in the port. In Delft, it's under the ground. And somebody goes to check on it. And maybe it's dark underground and they take a lantern. Maybe that's what causes it. Maybe it's a spark from turning the key, rusty key in the door, having been checked for a long time. Anyway, the whole thing instantly blew up. And there are paintings and drawings of it. Some of them by people who actually were there. Some of them kind of a bit fictional. There's one in which, you know, everybody's being blown into the sky like characters in ejector seats from planes and so on. But he was painting that day. His house fell instantly in the thunderclap. All the other people, the sitter, his mother-in-law, the person who was mixing the paints, they were all killed instantly. He wasn't. He survived for a few hours until help eventually came and they rushed him into the centre of Delft. Only a matter of, you know, three streets and two tiny little bridges over canals. And he died with his wounds at twilight on that same day, 12th of October 1654. So did a lot of other people. The main painter of this tragedy is a man called Egbert van der Poel, and he lived on the same street as a friend and neighbour of Fabricius. And his own daughter died in this tragedy too. She was buried on the same day as Carol Fabricius. And he painted that scene over and over and over again, and it's called, captioned, 12th October 1654. And he's always returning to this terrible moment, partly because he was a sort of disaster artist himself. He painted huge fires, scenes of, you know, devastation caused by fire. But this was something he actually saw. And when you look at the paintings, which are, you know, by no means great works like, you know, paintings of like Vermeer or Fabricius, but they are quite descriptively accurate insofar as what you see is like ground zero. It's a black hole at the center of each of these paintings, which is basically where the whole of this gunpowder explosion has turned to dark water and created a massive hole in the middle of the land, really. And one of the people at the Blast Institute compared it with Beirut, but another also to what happened in the Twin Towers, which is just total. People just literally vanished and nobody knows what happened.
So there's lots of other relatively unknown Dutch painters that you talk about in this book. We're not going to have time to talk about them. One of them that I am now absolutely obsessed with is Adrian Cortes, who obsessively paints vegetables on the same shelf, but they are just absolutely stunning. But I want to spend the last portion of the interview inevitably talking about Vermeer, who was a contemporary of Fabricius in Delft at the time, a little bit younger than him. Maybe they knew each other, maybe they didn't, but certainly Vermeer owned some of his paintings. And of course, since this book has been finished, there has been this incredible Vermeer exhibition. We went to it at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. 28 of only 36 paintings, which doesn't sound as impressive now that we know that Fabritius only has about 10 or 12. But 28 of his paintings collected together, one of which was a painting you talk about in this book quite a bit, The Little Street. So I'd just like to finish off talking about what that painting means to you, Laura.
Well, that painting is actually the inspiration for the entire book in a way, because I had a reproduction of it pinned on my wall all the way through lockdown, and I'm just obsessed with it because it shows just a little section of a street with a Dutch gable house, you know, stepping up towards this rather steady, beautiful, slightly overcast sky, and a few people doing some chores. And I can't tell you how staggering that painting is to me. Its beauty is inexhaustible and very mysterious to me. And certainly when I went to the Rijksmuseum, like you, and stood in front of that painting, which I've seen many times, but I never before had I seen so many people absolutely stunned by it. For some people, it's his greatest painting. What is it about this marquetry of tiles and windows and doorways and, you know, the stepped gable? What is it about it that makes it so sublime and so orderly and so beautiful? And so I'm very haunted by that painting. I love it very, very passionately. It's one of his only two outside scenes, the other one being also called View of Delft. And I'm also very interested because it's a house that he knew. He might have lived in it. His aunt probably owned it. And I know that when Fabricius is killed, his widow or someone sells three paintings by Fabricius to Vermeer. And they must have gone through more or less the door in that painting and been hung on the hall that you could see if you could just only enter that scene, open up like a doll's house and go inside. And he loved Fabricius and Vermeer. My God, you know, what judgment. He was so right.
So I've been talking to Laura Cumming. We've been talking about her book, Thunderclap, a memoir of art and life and sudden death, which is out now in the UK from Chatto & Windus. Laura, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
My pleasure, as always, Neil. Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.